Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are doing something a little different today because we are tackling a ghost story.
A ghost story. I thought we were talking about macroeconomics.
We are, but hear me out. We're looking at credit market frictions, specifically based on chapter 19 of our source material.
Okay.
And the reason I'm calling it a ghost story is because for about 30 years, economists basically pretended that the financial sector, well, that it didn't exist. It was like a ghost. It was there haunting everything, but the serious people just refused to acknowledge it.
That is a very dramatic way to put it, but
Yeah.
you're not wrong. It's what we call the great disconnect.
It blew my mind reading the introduction. There's this startling fact that before the Great Recession hit in 2008, mainstream analysis,
Yeah, the stuff used by central
the
banks.
stuff used by central banks and top universities, largely ignored banks. They just ignored Wall Street.
They did.
How is that even possible? I mean, we had the Great Depression in 1929. The defining image of the Depression is a run on the banks.
Right, people banging on the doors.
Exactly, trying to get their cash out. How could the smartest people in the room look at the economy for the next 70 years and just say, "Eh, the banks aren't that important"?
It does seem baffling in hindsight. It's sort of like a doctor studying the human body, but deciding that, blood flow isn't really worth measuring.
That's a great analogy.
But you have to understand the mindset, the prevailing view pre-2008.
Which was what exactly? Just
It
optimism.
was theoretical elegance. I mean, economists knew markets weren't perfect. They knew that sometimes you go to the bank for a loan and get rejected. They weren't blind.
Sure.
But they assumed those frictions, those imperfections, were minor. They thought they were just bumps in the road that smoothed out over time. The assumption was that you could model the economy as this, like, frictionless machine and still get the right answers about inflation and GDP.
So they thought the real economy, factories, workers, widgets, that was the engine, and finance was just the paint job.
Or maybe the oil. Important, but the engine is strong, the oil just kind of flows. There's actually a famous anecdote about this that highlights just how deep this blind spot went.
Oh, yeah.
In 2002, there was this massive, definitive volume published on the Great Depression. It was edited by Kehoe and Prescott. I mean, absolute heavyweights in the field.
The definitive history.
The definitive history.
Right.
And in this massive book, there wasn't a single chapter devoted to financial frictions or bank failures.
You're kidding me. A book on the Great Depression without a chapter on the banks collapsing.
Not one. That is how confident the field was that real factors like productivity shocks were the only things that mattered. And then obviously 2008 happened.
Right. The oil leaked out, the engine seized, and the car exploded.
Exactly. And everyone woke up with a massive hangover, realizing that finance wasn't just the oil, it was the driver. So our mission today is to retrace that realization. We need to unpack how we move from that frictionless fantasy land to a model that actually explains the messy reality credit crunches, panics, and, why a problem on Wall Street ends up costing people their jobs on Main Street.
Okay, let's start with the evidence. Because if we're going to claim the old experts were wrong, we need to bring receipts. Why should we care about the link between finance and the real economy?
The data is pretty damning. If you look at the charts, specifically figure 19.1 and 19.2 in the chapter, you see that credit flows are what we call highly pro-cyclical.
Pro-cyclical. That sounds like a fair weather friend.
That's actually a perfect analogy. When the economy is sunny and booming, banks are like desperate to give you money. Debt growth skyrockets.
Right.
But the second the storm clouds roll in, when a recession hits, that friend disappears. Credit just shuts off.
And it's not just that they stop lending, right? It gets more expensive.
Oh, much more expensive. We track this using something called credit spreads.
I see this on the news sometimes. Spreads are widening. I'll be honest, I tune it out.
You shouldn't. It's like the vital signs of the economy. A credit spread is just the difference between the interest rate a regular company pays on a bond versus what the government pays.
So it's the risk premium. The government's safe, the company's risky.
Correct. And right before a recession, those spreads spike vertically. Suddenly, the cost for a business to borrow money jumps way, way above the safe rate.
And at the same time, banks are.
At the same time, bank loan officers report tightening standards.
Which is just corporate speak for we aren't lending to anyone unless they can prove they don't need the money.
Precisely.
But let me play devil's advocate here, and the chapter brings this up too. Is this a chicken and egg situation?
It's the big question.
Does the drop in credit cause the recession, or do businesses just stop borrowing because, the economy sucks and they don't want to build new factories anyway?
That is the causality puzzle, and it's the million-dollar question. The chapter breaks this down into three ways of seeing the world. Scenario one is the passive view. That's the old-school view we just bashed.
The finance is boring view.
Right. Real productivity drops, so companies demand fewer loans. Finance just mirrors the real economy. Post-2008, almost nobody believes this is the whole story anymore.
Okay, so what's scenario two?
Scenario two is propagation. This is where it gets interesting. Imagine a small, real problem happens. Let's say the price of oil goes up a bit or productivity dips.
The speed bump.
The speed bump. In a perfect world, the economy would just slow down slightly. But with financial frictions, that speed bump turns into a pothole that destroys your suspension.
How so?
The bad news makes banks nervous. They pull back lending. That makes it harder for firms to operate, which makes the economy worse, which makes banks more nervous.
So it's a megaphone. It takes a whisper of bad news and just shouts it.
Exactly. That's amplification. And then you have scenario three, financial shocks. This is the scary one. This is when the trouble starts inside the house.
The call is coming from inside the building.
Yes.
Right.
The financial sector itself just freaks out. Maybe a big bank fails, or there's a panic about housing assets. The real economy was fine yesterday, but suddenly the credit supply vanishes.
So the factory is still standing, the workers are ready, the customers are there, but the money just stops.
And that leads to a recession caused purely by finance. But to understand how that works, though, we have to build a model. We have to really understand why the market isn't perfect.
Right. And to do that, we have to talk about pizza,
Bika.
the Modigliani-Miller principle, the most famous pizza analogy in all of economics.
Ah, yes, the frictionless benchmark.
So, for the listeners, lay out the perfect world scenario. Why did economists think finance didn't matter?
So Modigliani and Miller, who won Nobel Prizes for this, they proved that in a frictionless market, it does not matter how a firm pays for its investments.
Debt or equity?
Whether they issue stock, which is equity, or take out a loan, which is debt, the value of the firm is the same.
And here's the pizza part. If I have a pepperoni pizza and I slice it into four huge slices or eight narrow slices, I still have the same amount of pizza.
Exactly. The pizza is the firm's assets, its factory, its ideas. The slices are just how you divide up the claims on that value. Whether you give slices to shareholders or slices to a bank, the pie doesn't get bigger.
So in this world, a CFO is basically wasting their time trying to optimize their debt structure.
In a frictionless world, yes,
Yeah.
real decisions, hiring, building are completely separate from financial structure. But we do not live in a frictionless world.
No, we live in a world with taxes, lawyers, and people who, lie.
And those are the frictions. To make our model realistic, the chapter introduces three specific gears, three frictions that break the Modigliani-Miller pizza.
Let's walk through these because this is the engine of the crisis. What is the first friction?
Friction number one is what I call the bait. It's the tax shield.
Right.
In the U.S. and many other economies, the government lets you deduct interest payments on debt from your taxes.
But you can't deduct dividends you pay to shareholders.
Correct. So the government is effectively subsidizing debt. They are paying you to borrow money. This means debt is artificially cheaper than equity.
So if I'm running a company, I don't look at debt and equity as equal slices of pizza anymore. The debt slice comes with a cash back rebate from the government.
Exactly. So your incentive is to load up on as much debt as humanly possible. You want to be leveraged to the hilt.
Okay, so every company wants infinite debt, but they can't get it. Why not?
That brings us to friction number two, the collateral collar, or the borrowing limit. The bank knows you want infinite money, but they also know they can't fully trust you.
This is the market incompleteness part, right?
It is. It's all about trust and enforcement.
Hmm.
If I lend you $1 billion, you might run away to a non-extradition country, or you might just be lazy.
Sure.
And because I can't watch you 24/7, and I can't legally enslave you to pay me back.
Which is generally frowned upon.
Generally, I have to protect myself. So I say, you can only borrow a fraction of what you can prove you own. If you have a factory worth $10 million, I'll lend you maybe $5 million against it. That's the limit. You hit a hard wall.
Okay, so we have the bait, which is cheap debt, and the wall, the collateral limit. What is the third piece? Because so far, if I hit the limit, couldn't I just issue some stock if I really needed cash?
You could, but you really, really don't want to. This is friction number three, the dividend anchor. We assume in this model, and this is true in real life, that firms hate cutting dividends.
Why? Is it just ego?
It's a signal. If a company slashes its dividend, the stock price usually tanks. It tells the market, we are in trouble. Plus, issuing new equity is expensive. You have underwriting fees, legal fees. So there's a cost to adjusting your equity.
I see the trap now. The government pays me to use debt, so I use it until I hit the bank's limit.
Right.
But then if a great investment opportunity comes along, I'm stuck. I can't borrow more because of the limit, and I can't use my own cash because of that dividend penalty.
Bingo. That is the aha moment. You need all three of these to create a crisis. If you could just switch to equity instantly and for free, the borrowing limit wouldn't matter that much.
You just swap credit cards.
But because you're locked in, the financial friction becomes real.
So now that we've built this trap, let's see what happens when it snaps shut. The outline talks about two main effects, dampening and amplification. Let's start with dampening because that sounds weird. How can these frictions make the economy quieter?
Think about a startup founder. She has a brilliant idea. Productivity is high. She wants to expand. In a perfect world, she borrows the money and builds 10 factories. Boom.
But she has a collateral collar.
Right. She doesn't have the assets yet. She just has the idea. The bank says no. So she has to fund the expansion out of her own pocket, which means cutting dividends, which is painful.
So she builds 2 factories instead of 10.
Exactly. So the boom is dampened. The economy grows, but not as fast as it should. It's holding us back. It acts like a tax on investment.
Okay, that makes sense. But the more dangerous one is amplification.
Right. This is often called the financial accelerator.
This is the spiral. Walk us through this.
Okay. So imagine the economy gets a little bit better, just a small bump. The value of your factory goes up.
Nice. My net worth is up.
And because you're leveraged, remember you use all that cheap debt, your net worth goes up a lot. It's like if you put 10% down on a house and the house price goes up 10%, you've doubled your money.
Leverage is magic on the way up.
But here's the kicker. Because your factory's worth more, the bank looks at your collateral and says, hey, your limit just went up. You can borrow more.
So I borrow more to buy more factories.
Yes. You borrow more, you invest more, which drives the price of capital up even further, which raises your limit even further.
It's a feedback loop.
A total feedback loop.
Yeah.
The financial system amplifies the small good news into a massive boom.
It sounds like a bubble machine.
It is. But mechanisms that spiral up can also spiral down. And this is where we get to the concept of asymmetry. This is a huge point in the chapter. The crash is not just the reverse of the boom. It's different.
This is the pushing on a string idea, right?
Exactly. Think about the borrowing limit. If the bank suddenly says, hey, good news, we raised your credit limit to $1 billion, but you only needed $1 million, what happens?
Nothing. I just go about my day.
Right. A positive financial shock doesn't force you to do anything.
Yeah.
But what if they lower your limit? What if that collateral collar tightens?
And I'm maxed out. I'm in trouble.
You're in deep trouble.
Yeah.
You are forced to deleverage immediately. You have to sell assets today. You have to fire people today. You can't wait.
So financial tightening hurts way more than financial loosening helps.
Precisely. That's why financial crises are sudden stops. They are violent. The elevator cable snaps. Whereas booms can be these slow, gradual escalations.
This brings us to the part of the deep dive that I think hits hardest. Because so far, we are talking about factories and balance sheets. But the biggest cost of the 2008 crisis wasn't lost stock value. It was lost jobs.
Correct. Millions of them.
And the chapter asks a really tough question. Capital investment is a small part of GDP, but labor is huge, like 60% of the economy. How does a bank panic lead to mass unemployment? Why does a factory owner fire a productive worker just because the bank is grumpy?
This is the labor wedge.
Yeah.
And to explain it, we have to look at something called working capital.
Okay, make this real for us. What does working capital mean for a business owner on Main Street?
Okay, picture a furniture maker. It's Thursday. He has a warehouse full of tables he built. He has orders from customers, but the customers haven't paid him yet. You know, corporate accounts pay in 60 or 90 days.
But his workers need their paychecks on Friday.
Exactly. He has a timing mismatch. He's rich in tables, but poor in cash.
I see.
In a standard economic model, we just assume he sells the table and pays the worker instantly. But in the real world, he needs a float. He needs a short-term loan from the bank just to cover payroll until the invoice is clear.
This is the lifeblood of small business.
It is. Now, imagine a financial shock hits. The collateral collar tightens. The bank calls him and says, sorry, we're cutting your credit line. No working capital loan this week.
He literally can't print the checks.
He can't. Even though the workers are productive, even though the tables are valuable, he has a liquidity crisis. The shadow price of that cash has just gone through the roof.
So he has to fire them.
He has to let them go. Not because of a lack of work, but because of a lack of finance. This effectively acts like a massive tax on labor. When credit spreads spike, the cost of keeping an employee skyrockets.
That is terrifying. It connects Wall Street directly to the unemployment line.
It does. And it explains why employment takes so long to recover after a financial crisis. Even if demand comes back, if the credit channels are still clogged, firms literally cannot afford to rehire.
So let's zoom out and look at the whole picture.
Yeah.
We started with a world where economists thought finance was a veil,
right,
that it didn't really change the outcome.
And we've ended up in a world where the plumbing, the loans, the collateral, the working capital actually dictates whether the water flows or not.
We realize that the government lures firms into debt with tax breaks. The banks trap them with collateral limits. And when a shock hits, that trap snaps shut, forcing massive sell-offs and layoffs because companies can't even afford the cash to pay their staff.
That is the grim mechanical reality of it. We move from finance doesn't matter to finance drives the business cycle.
And you mentioned something earlier about a shadow price. I want to leave the listeners with that thought. The model uses a variable, let's call it the desperation premium, to track how badly firms need cash.
Yes. In the math, it's the multiplier on the borrowing constraint. But in the real world, it matches up almost perfectly with those credit spreads we see on the news.
So when I see those spreads widening on CNBC,
you aren't just seeing stock traders getting nervous. You are seeing the shadow price of liquidity rising. You are watching the cost of keeping the economic engine running go vertical.
That puts a whole new spin on the headlines.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves us with a big question for the future. You know, corporate debt is at record highs again. Firms are optimized for cheap money. So is the next recession going to be a simple dip in productivity? Or are we just waiting for the collateral collar to tighten again?
Wow.
Are we just waiting for the bank to change their mind about what our world is worth?
A sobering thought to end on. Just because the factory is running doesn't mean the financing isn't about to dry up.
Keep your eyes on the spreads.
Thanks for diving deep with us today. We'll catch you on the next one.